Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 92-year-old Walt Burr. Originally from New Jersey, he's made his home in Merced, California since 1951. Pay him a visit there and you might convince him to show you the logbook he kept for 60 missions in F-4U Corsairs in the Pacific during World War II. And you'll probably see the photo you can also find at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, proving that this recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross can still fit into the jacket he wore in the cockpit more than 70 years ago.
So you get through all this training in the Corsair, and you know, most people are familiar with that plane and the unique shape of its wings, and maybe they remember, you know, the TV show with the Pappy Boyington character flying all his F-4U Corsairs. The first time that you flew it in combat, do you remember that first mission?
Yeah.
And this is from the carrier USS Essex?
Yes.
Which is loaded not just with Corsairs, but all kinds of planes.
F-6Fs and Helldivers and torpedo planes.
What was that day like? Were you nervous, anxious?
Oh, yes. It was a pre-dawn launch, and I was carrying a 1,000-pound bomb, and I was on the catapult, and I had never been on a catapult, and I knew what was supposed to happen, but I had never been on a catapult, and I had never had a 1,000-pound bomb. I'd had practice bombs, little ones. On the Corsair, there was a little handle that could pull out, and when you shoved the throttle forward, your fingers could hook onto this thing so you could keep the throttle full on. Well, I was pushing the throttle forward, and I hadn't hooked it all the way on. It wasn't fully on, and they fired the catapult, and I wasn't ready. And my hand came off the throttle and went back and caught on something. So I had one hand to do everything and carrying this 1,000-pound bomb. But it flew, and I held it, and I got my hand out, and everything came out all right.
Well, you say that, but I'm sure that's not what it felt like at the time. So you're the hand that's supposed to hold on to that, because they fire the catapult when you're not ready. It gets thrown back and then hooked on something, so you can't get it free, and you're with the other hand trying to control the plane and make sure the throttle's on.
Right.
And probably feeling a little sense of panic.
Well, no, mad. I want to kill the officer, the guy that fired me off. I use that term literally. I didn't want to kill him, but I want to...
Sure. Everybody knows what you mean. If you saw him, you'd have a word for him.
Oh, I did when I got back.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah.
But first you had to fly this mission. Where were you? What was the target?
Japan, Kyushu.
And in fact, your group, that air group, did more damage to Japan in those next few months than any other air group, from what I understand.
Yeah, we did quite a bit. We did our share of bombing and strafing and whatever. We were on a dive bombing run on that first day. At first flight, we lost 3 pilots. Mm. And one of the reason we did is that some of us that were in that group had been trained as a dive bomber pilot. And we were now dive bombing in the Corsair. The dive bombing regime goes down one at a time following each other. And that's what we did. And the Japs jumped us when we were pulling out and all strung out and not able to defend ourselves for that brief period of time.
So after you make your dive and release your bomb and you're coming back out, they would swarm around you before you could get the other fighters to help?
Yeah, right. And after that, we went down in pairs. I would fly on somebody's wing, or somebody would fly on a wing on me. We'd go down, 2 of us. The one who was leading that 2-plane section would pick the target and go down, and you'd go down with them, and both of you would bomb the same thing at the same time.
And then you were there to protect each other after.
Yeah. The way we protected each other was a thing called the thatch weave. Instead of being up close like we were to the dive, we'd spread out the turning radius of the plane, and if a Jap jumped me, my partner would turn towards me and I'd turn towards him, and we'd do this a weave so that whoever was being attacked by the Jap would be attacked by my partner, or I would be attacking if the
right.
Japanese pilot had jumped my partner. I would turn towards him, and he'd do the weave. We'd do the weave. That allowed us to shoot at the Jap.
But it also probably adds a little more danger to it if you're crossing paths at that high rate of speed with the third aircraft mixed in there, too.
Oh, yes. But that was great. We got to shoot at the Jap. And he didn't like that because they were good pilots and all, but they didn't have the armor plate and the self-sealing gas tanks that we had. You had some protection. Usually the Japanese didn't want to get involved with you once you were in the position to do that.
So the strength in numbers was a deterrent.
Right.
And you mentioned the three pilots from your group that didn't come back that day. When did you figure that out? Did you see any of that happen, or is that something you learned upon return?
Learned upon return.
And did anybody shoot at you on that first mission?
Well, I guess they did, but I didn't know. They didn't hit me.
Yeah.
You know, you have to keep in mind that all this happens at a rather fast pace. When you get back to the ship and you talk about it, you ask, did you see Smitty go down or whatever? Maybe you saw it and maybe you didn't. You know, you don't hang around to see what you did.
Yeah, or else you won't be around to do another one. But when you did get back to your ship and you found out that those three planes were missing, that those three friends of yours?
Oh, yes.
You don't know if they're coming back? How did you deal with that?
I really can't tell you. You just knew that it could happen, and it happened, and so you just feel badly, of course, feel badly that you lost a friend, but that's part of it. Tomorrow it could be you. You eat dinner, you go to bed, you get up and have breakfast, and you do it again.
And I guess I didn't ask you, that's three out of how many? How many Corsair pilots did you have on there?
Probably 16.
That's it. So three out of the 16 guys on your very first mission don't come back. Do you have a count of how many missions you flew over there?
Oh, yeah. If I remember right, it was about 60.
Over the stretch of?
Well, we were on the Essex for 10 months, but we were not in combat for the whole 10 months.
Right.
We'd be in combat, then the ship would pull back and refuel and rearm, and you'd have, in effect, a day off. But you still, some of you would fly combat air patrol over the ship most every day.
Just to be ready in case kamikazes came in?
Or any Japanese.
Sure. I feel like I'm barely scratching the surface of what you went through, especially if you had 60 missions. There have to be some instances that stand out along the way where you came close, where it could have been you.
No, you don't even think about it when you get back.
Some landings on that carrier that were less than normal?
There was lots of landings that were not normal, but I never had. Everyone is a controlled crash. I mean, it's not a crash in that it bangs up the airplane, but it's, if you don't do it just right, you're going to have a problem. And when you caught a wire, if you caught with your hook, that cable actually would stop you, the hook. But if you got too near the edge and you caught the cable, it'd just throw you over the side, or you were going to have some kind of a crash. And once in a while, the plane would not catch a hook, and they've lost too much power. They're coming down. They pulled the throttle off, so it's just idling. And across the ship, they had big arms that would come up about 5 feet high or 6 feet high, something like that, with cable across. And that would keep you from crashing into the planes that were on the front of the deck, because we didn't have the slanted deck
right
that they have now.
This is a flat top.
This is just one deck. So when I land, I taxi in front of these cables down. I taxi over them in the front of the plane, and they raise it up for the next guy coming in, landing behind me. And if he doesn't catch a wire, those cables will stop him most all the time. If he really floats high, he would go over the cables and crash into the planes in the front, and then you have a real mess.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen too often. Those cables usually stop you.
What's the hairiest landing that you remember?
I had a 1,000-pound bomb that I couldn't get rid of.
Uh-oh.
I couldn't get it off.
It's armed?
Well, the bomb is safe until the fuse arms it.
Right.
The bomb, you can drop it 1,000 feet. It's nothing going to happen. It's just going to bounce.
Uh-huh.
But there's a little propeller or impeller that arms the fuse that's been put in the front of the bomb. And once that happens, the bomb is live. But there's a safety wire in there that, as long as it will come off when you drop the bomb.
Right.
Well, if you don't drop the bomb, the safety wire is still there. Anyway, I couldn't get rid of this bomb. I couldn't get it off.
You had tried to release it, didn't you? Probably shook the wings a little bit.
I did all kinds of maneuvers trying to shake it loose. I couldn't. So last resort, you come in with the bomb on, and I caught a wire and stopped. I saw everybody's head went down. Well, if the bomb had gone off, putting their heads down wouldn't have done any good, and I'd have been blown up.
You'd be in a million pieces.
But the bomb hit the propeller. It came off when I caught the wire, landed on the deck, and nothing happened. And
so you come in, you catch the wire, the bomb pops off, slides across the deck, and everybody's ducking, waiting for it to explode.
Yeah, but it wouldn't, if it was going to explode, ducking wouldn't have made, it would have been too late.
But were you sure it wasn't going to explode?
Well, I didn't know. There was nothing I could do about it. I'm sitting in the cockpit. I realized when everybody started ducking, and I heard the propeller hit the bomb. It was just a tick.
Yeah.
But anyway, nothing happened. We didn't explode, obviously.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic. You're the one who lived through it, and I know you're very humble about everything you did, and you're making it sound like no big deal. But by this point, you've tried everything you can to get rid of this sucker. You probably exhausted all your fuel, and that's why you have to land finally?
Well, I'm getting pretty low, yeah. But
this has been building to this point this whole time, and now you're finally bringing it in, and it's literally do or die, right?
Right.
So what goes through your mind as you're approaching that carrier?
Just do my thing. And if I couldn't get rid of it, it's probably going to stay on. Well, it didn't stay on. It came off.
I'm sure you had some rough weather that you had to try to take off and land in also.
Oh, yes. It's almost humorous. In this bad weather, there's always a two-plane standby on the catapults. And you're sitting in that plane for a while. And somebody else will sit in it some more. And the weather was terrible. You couldn't see. But the ship moved around and the weather would be a little spotty. At one point, the 900-foot long flight deck, you couldn't see from the front to the back or the back to the front. It was that bad, but they did get a little bit better. Well, radar said there was a bogey out there. I don't know why any self-respecting Japanese pilot would be out there flying around and that stuff. But so they fired us off, the two of us off, and started vectoring us around. We couldn't see one if he was across the street from us.
Wow.
And we were in the cloud. And we vectored us here and vectored us there and vectored us around. We kept telling them we can't see anything, but we were doing what we were told. Anyway, they finally brought us right in over the destroyer that was running the radar, and they started shooting at us. They're looking at us on the radar.
So they're shooting based on that with no visual contact.
And we told them on the radio what what the scoop was.
I'm sure that was a nice, clean, calm conversation.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, they stopped shooting and they didn't hit us. But we were up about 3 hours on that flight and we never saw anything. And there was no bogey. There was no Japanese out there. And if there was, we couldn't have seen him.
Yeah, really, you put your lives at stake for no reason, it sounds like.
Basically, well, that's the way it goes. Those are the things that happen. Like I said, it's almost laughable. All this effort and nothing.
Yeah.
But you never know.
And you never know where these conversations are going to take us. You definitely don't want to miss the rest of Walt Burr's story. I'll read you his Distinguished Flying Cross citation when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.